that was my hook bird. That was the one that got me. And I was like, this is really cool.
Quarantine life got you down? Today on Outside In, a family guide to backyard birding.
Darkish head, red belly.
Tips on what to listen for, how to watch, and how to get something useful out of all the cardboard toilet paper tubes that you've got lying around.
Put those tubes together, and those tubes together become binoculars.
They're super easy to make, so I love watching birds.
Plus, one producer's mission to shed his disgust for insects. Can't we all just learn to love bugs?
Mm-hmm. It's going somewhere. My like toes are curling. That's tight.
How you feeling? Are you habituating?
I think I am habituating. I'm like not shaking as much.
We're all about the birds and the bugs after the news.
At the end of his tail feathers, he's like silver. It's kind of silver.
Very regal. Just sit.
Yes. I love watching birds.
Hey folks, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Right now, there are a lot of us who are feeling a little cooped up. So we've been trying to find little ways of exploring the magic of nature from the safety of our home and our neighborhood. Over the next couple months, we'll be putting out a handful of shorter segments for families and individuals who want to discover how, even when we're all stuck inside, the natural world ties us together. And we're starting with bird watching. Producer Taylor Quimby and his son Phineas take us from here.
Okay, we've got another bird. He's come down, he's by the grass. Looks like the same kind to me.
Mm-hmm, yeah. In right yellow beak. I saw his yellow beak up on the tree.
Yellow beak.
There is a kind of bird watching, or birding, where people travel all over the world to see as many types of birds as possible. But there's another type of bird watching that anybody can do, from the comfort of a backyard or even a kitchen window, without any special tools or bird expertise at all. That's the type of birding we're going to talk about today, and we've roped in a few bird lovers to give us some tips on how to do it. First up is Bridget.
So, hi, my name's Bridget Butler. I live in northern Vermont, right near the Quebec border, and I'm known as the bird diva.
Bridget started young. She still remembers waking up in a tent next to an apple tree on a bird watching trip, and having her first real bird experience, you know, like the one.
It was spring, and there's the apple tree in blossom, and at the top of the tree is an indigo bunting.
Indigo buntings are cheery, little bright blue birds with a wonderful sing-song voice that migrate at night, using the stars to guide them.
And this guy is just singing his heart out, and that was my hook bird. That was the one that got me, and I was like, this is really cool.
Bridget teaches classes on how to do what she calls slow birding, which, when she describes it, sounds a little bit like yoga or meditation practice.
I encourage people to start right out your back door. My sit spot is literally on my back step.
If you've got a backyard or a quiet outdoor spot you can safely get to, let's go there together. Here's how she likes to start bird watching.
Just slow your steps down. Take notice of how your body is feeling. Drop your shoulders.
You see, birdwatching isn't just about looking for birds. It's about opening up your senses, about bringing your mind into the present.
Get comfortable. Take a couple of deep cleansing breaths.
If you don't have a backyard, or you live in a building with a lot of other people, it's okay just to open a window and start there. Even high up, you'd be surprised what birds are out there. Did you know that the fastest bird in the world, the peregrine falcon, likes to roost and hunt in New York City, right around the skyscrapers? Anyway, I've been trying Bridget's method in the mornings. I like to brew up some coffee, open up my kitchen window, and stick my head right out into the sunshine. Sometimes your mind might wander, a noisy car drives by, or a person who wonders why you're sticking your head out the window.
Morning.
Don't worry about it.
Acknowledge them and like let them go. And then open up your senses, take a deep breath, smell.
Some days, you'll notice you can hear a lot of birds, but you don't see any. Don't worry, that's normal. One of the most important birding tools you have are your ears. Bridget has a little exercise to help get them working.
The other part that I like to think about is, how far away can I listen? Can I listen close? Can I listen to my neighbor's house? Can I listen beyond my neighbor's house? Can I listen above me and in front of me?
Really good birders can identify a lot of birds just by their songs and calls, and can even tell whether the bird is looking for a mate or warning other birds about nearby predators. That's not the case for beginners like me and my son. So Bridget gave us some things to listen for, a few bird call genres, so to speak.
One of them is like the clear sound, like chickadee. So black-capped chickadees, we have them in Vermont here, you have them where you guys are there in New Hampshire. So their mating song is, "Hey, sweetie, hey, sweetie." You can actually whistle that.
Another category of bird call you might hear is what's called a trill.
And you do that with your tongue. Kind of choppy da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da quality to it.
And yet another category is a buzzy sort of insect sound.
So if you're like zzzz. Some birds have all of those within their song, which is really cool. So the song may start out one way with a nice clear note and then go into something that's more buzzy toward the end.
Listen to this guy, the brown thrasher. He has more than 1,000 song types and can even do covers of other bird songs.
Like a squeak and a chirp mixed together.
Let me hear. What does it sound like to you? Well, that's pretty good. Finn, you're doing really good sound.
Thanks.
It's funny they call it bird watching.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of it is about bird listening.
Yeah, I think they should call it bird listening.
If you're lucky and patient, the birds that you hear might wander into view. To get a sense of what to look for should you actually see one, we talked to D. Drew Lanham, an ornithologist and professor at Clemson University in South Carolina. He didn't have a hook bird like Bridget. When he was a kid, Drew wanted to be a hook bird.
I would go out and attempt to fly. I would construct wings of cardboard, parachutes of plastic bags, tried to float down from ladders, haystacks, and roofs with umbrellas. Sometimes there was evidence. I did break a collarbone.
Point is, Drew admired birds.
A second grade teacher, a woman by the name of Ms. Beasley, she gave us pictures of birds to color. That started it.
When observing a bird on a branch or on the ground or in the sky, it's best to think of yourself as an investigator.
If this, then that. If this, then that, not that.
Don't jump to a conclusion about what kind of bird you're seeing. To start with, just gather clues.
Is the bird larger or smaller than a crow?
And of course, pay close attention to color.
And not just thinking Roy G. Biv.
Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet.
But beginning to think about shades, to have fun with describing colors.
Apricot, scarlet, almond, aquamarine. You're not just looking at color to identify the species. Just like an investigator, some small clues may tell you a lot more than you think. Most male birds, for instance, have brighter colors than females. The adult male summer tanager, Drew tells me, is watermelon red. The female is a mustardy yellow. Young males are a splotchy patchwork of the two.
Those splotchy colors tell you that that's a male that was hatched just last year.
Drew says to keep asking yourself questions about what you're seeing. Jot down the notes, maybe even draw a picture in your notebook if you can.
Look at the bill. Is the bill long or is the bill short? Is it conical shaped or is it sharp?
Of course, birds can be small and you might be looking from a distance.
Binoculars can help you.
Don't have a pair?
I'll tell you, you can take toilet paper tubes, which I think there are probably plenty of these days. Put those tubes together and those tubes together become binoculars.
They're super easy to make, so.
Okay, so maybe a pair of toilet paper tube binoculars won't help you zoom in. But we tried them, and what they did do was help us focus our attention.
I can't believe it, but these cardboard tube binoculars actually really do help.
Mm-hmm. Plus, they were fun.
Hey, Finn, look. There's another one. Okay. What size is he? Is he bigger or smaller than a crow?
He's smaller than a crow. Darkish head. Red belly.
What's his beak shape?
Like a snout point, a pointy snout.
I really like watching birds, but I've never spent much time trying to identify them. Luckily, if you do the investigative legwork, there are some really helpful tools out there for beginners like me and Finn. One of them is an app that Bridget suggested called Merlin, made by the folks at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology.
It's like magic. You hit go and it spits out a list of possible birds based on your location.
Cool.
House finch.
House finch. No.
No. Purple finch.
No.
No.
Yep.
American robin.
Mm-hmm.
That really looks like what we saw.
Yeah.
What does it say?
Fairly large songbird with ground body, long legs.
The folks at Cornell aren't just trying to help people identify birds. They're also looking for volunteers, like you, to help them collect data.
All day long, I've been watching this eastern phoebe has been bringing nest materials to my back porch.
This is Robin Bailey. Her first bird ID was also, can you believe it, a robin. And she is the project manager for NestWatch, one of Cornell's citizen science projects that anyone can contribute to. If there's a bird nest that you can see from your window or in your backyard, she wants to hear about it.
These data are the foundation of what we know about how birds nest, how many eggs they lay, how successful they are, and why. We would be getting all kinds of data from just that bird that's nesting on your front porch, in your flower pot.
Robin says citizen bird watchers help their team monitor somewhere between 27 and 28,000 nests every year. And with all the changes we've been experiencing lately, this could be a really valuable time to study bird nesting behavior.
I'm curious if this spring, with things being really quiet outside, if birds will do anything differently.
Whether you're collecting data or just watching out the window for fun, there really is something amazing about birds, isn't there?
Some warbler that ends up in your yard is your link to a tropical rainforest. That's that's pretty amazing to me that the birds that someone saw in Central America just a few days ago are suddenly in my backyard. That again is stitching the world together with feathers.
And even though you might not be able to visit your friends or your family in person, you can do what Drew does. Think of the birds outside your window as messengers, little gifts that we can send to one another.
I just wrote a friend of mine, and I said, Frank, I'm sending you black-throated green warblers. They're here now. I know that there are some of them headed your way.
Who knows? Maybe if you're paying close enough attention, I'll send a bird your way, too.
Chee-weep. Chee-weep. I'm going to write that down. Chee-weep. Chee-weep.
Hey, sweetie.
Thank you.
That's producer Taylor Quimby and his son, Phineas. Now, like we mentioned at the top, capital B birding for some people is an activity that feels a bit like a sport. There are lists, competitions. I have to say, all that is not for me. So if what we're doing with this episode is encouraging people who are stuck at home to try out backyard birding, I want to use this opportunity to instill a new value in all of these new birders.
Sure.
I want you to fall in love with common birds.
I'm Karen Purcell.
And to help you do that, we're going to talk to Karen.
I am project leader for Celebrate Urban Birds at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, which is a citizen science project that's available really all over the continent. It's available in both Spanish and English, and it's for beginner birders or folks that are just interested in learning about birds in their neighborhood, whether it be a city or the suburbs or the country.
Now, I'm not a birder, or at least I'm a really bad birder, but I do know my birds. I know the Eastern Phoebe building a nest under the porch. I know the American Robin building a nest on the garage. I know the various types of woodpeckers constantly hammering the trees all around my house. And so does my son.
No woodpecker.
Which is why I really like Celebrate Urban Birds. It's a citizen science project, which if you're just trying to start something new, like starting to pay attention to birds because you want that distraction, it'll give you some structure.
It is citizen science, and so there are very clear protocols or instructions on how to watch. And the reason we provide those is because if we want to be able to compare the data that or the observations that I'm collecting here in Ithaca with someone in New York City or in Los Angeles, we need to, everybody to be watching or observing in the same way.
You pick an area about the size of half a basketball court and sit out for 10 minutes, three times a month. And you write down any birds that you see in your little personal study area. The birds you're looking for are mostly really common ones. Robins, crows, mourning doves, pigeons. But here's the catch. Yes, this is, quote, for science, unquote. But just forget about that for a second. The science is just an excuse. That's just a commitment device to get you out the door. Now you're out here. You're sitting in your spot where you can see your half a basketball court and a bird. Something has actually flitted into the spot that you're studying. Now, do not pick up your pencil.
Well, one of the most common mistakes that we see people make are that they see a bird and they're super excited about seeing the bird. And so they immediately then shift their eyes from the bird to their app or their guide. And what we recommend is not to do that. If you see a bird, keep watching that bird. Watch everything about it. And then when the bird flies away, then actually go and try to figure out what it is.
Karen probably wouldn't put it this way, but I'll say it. Citizen science. Yeah, it gathers data in a rigorous way that researchers can use, but a lot of times, that's kind of just the side benefit. A lot of times, they've designed these projects with the goal of breaking us out of our routine, of showing us something that's wonderful and powerful and right in front of our eyes if we can just stop looking at our darn phones for a second. And that's one of the reasons birds, especially common birds, urban birds, are so perfect. They're a miracle, and they're right in front of us. Take pigeons.
I am stuck on pigeons. I just think pigeons are fascinating. The fact that they feed their young pigeon milk in the first week of life, and that males and the females take such equal turns in raising the young and making the nest, and it's just, to me, the behaviors of pigeons are just really interesting. I think a lot of folks say, well, I've never seen a pigeon nest or, you know, a young pigeon, but you do see young pigeons all the time. they look like adults, but they've got their cirri, or the little skin that's above their nose, is a different color. And so, again, watching little details like that is super fascinating. Killdeer is another bird that I just, I absolutely love, in particular because of the behaviors that they will engage in when they see a person or a predator coming towards their nest. They will, they deserve some kind of Broadway award. They throw themselves on the ground, and right on the underwing, they've got some a little bit of red, so it looks like they're hurt. They will flop around on the ground. And so if you're a fox and you're headed for their nest and about to eat their eggs, but suddenly you see a hurt bird, a hurt adult, and that becomes a tasty treat. And so you start following the adult as it flops around, and you don't notice that it's flopping around and guiding you away from the nest. And so you keep following it, and then suddenly it flies off. And at that point, you don't remember where the nest is.
I don't want to be too harsh on the capital B birders. I love obsessives and passionate people. I've just decided that lists and driving all over creation just to twitch a rare bird isn't for me. But this, knowing the whole story of the birds I see out my window every day, being able to take one brief look and know that, yep, there's the Phoebe, sitting on the fence post, sallying out to catch a fly whenever one drifts within range. She's having her morning hunt. Or seeing a downy woodpecker working on a white pine and knowing, yeah, that tree probably isn't doing so well. Looks like it's full of rot and bugs, and maybe it'll come down in a few years. These are the stories that birds bring us. And frankly, these are the kinds of stories I need to fill my head with right now. Coming up, they might not be here yet, but the bugs are coming back. It's another way that we can interact with the outdoors from the safety of our homes, even if we'd rather not. Can we learn to love the bug? Stick around. Welcome back to Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown.
Hey, Sam.
Jimmy Gutierrez.
So, I know you're not a movie buff.
I'm not a movie buff.
Have you ever seen The Fly?
I've not seen The Fly.
There is a limit, even to the imagination.
It was like sci-fi horror. It opens up with this eccentric and devilishly handsome scientist, Jeff Goldblum.
Oh!
Right?
Wait, is this why he was the scientist in Jurassic Park? Was because he was the scientist in The Fly?
I mean, the lineage is there.
Okay.
He's at this press event, and it's kind of like cocktail hour, and he's trying to get the attention of this journalist, Gina Davis, who is looking foine.
Sorry, I have three other interviews to do before this party's over.
Yeah, but they're not working on something that'll change the world as we know it.
So they leave this party. He wants to show her this project that he's working on. And to get right into it, Goldblum has figured out a way to transport inanimate objects from one place to another.
Teleportation.
So he's built this teleportation device. Eventually, he figures out how to teleport living things. So one night, he gets a little drunk, and he decides he's going to try this out on himself.
What are we waiting for? Let's do it.
But little did he know that when he transports, there is a fly in the teleporter with him. Him and the fly fuse on a molecular level. At first, all is bueno. He's got fly superpowers. He's got more clarity. He's got, like, fly super strength. He also can go all night, apparently.
When we say go,
we're talking go.
If you don't have any fluid left in your body, we've been doing this for hours.
But then he starts to change in not so great ways.
Everything about you is changing. You look bad. You smell bad.
I've never been much of a bather.
And this is where it becomes like a classic horror film. There's like peak horror makeup, peak Goldblum, the best like metamorphic scene of all time, and that's when he goes full fly. And it's disgusting.
Jimmy, as fun as this is, why are we talking about The Fly?
We're talking about The Fly Samuel. Because I want to know how you feel about insects.
I wish I was a better person who could. So you know, like, you're like host of a podcast about science and nature. Like, you should be trying to get people excited about them. But I
have never been good with them.
Mm.
I find them unnerving. And I hate the feeling of them on you, in particular the like bug leg feeling.
Yep.
Really, really unsettling to me.
I will co-sign everything that you just said. And that is why we are talking about The Fly. I find them disgusting. Like, I feel like they were made to kill. Like, that feeling, it's like, whap, right?
My feeling is that my fear is irrational. That's how I feel about my fear.
I think it's very rational.
But
there was a story that came out last year. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to hate bugs, but there was a story that came out last year about this woman in Taiwan who had a bunch of bees in her eyes drinking her tears. I mean, what kind of monsters are we dealing with? If I told you about how many flies I've killed in my life, I think you'd want to end this conversation, unfortunately.
Well, you know, insects reproduce at a tremendous rate, so I suspect that your devastation of those flies is just a drop in the ocean.
This is Jenny Angus. She is an educator, artist, and so-called insect ally.
So-called.
So-called. She wants people to imagine bugs leading lives just like ours, with families, curiosities, just trying to make it.
Maybe they don't deserve that swat with the fly swatter, the rolled-up newspaper, or worse yet, the blast of raid, that they could perhaps be gently ushered out of the house. After all, who was here first, really?
So Jenny's been sourcing and collecting bugs for 20 years from all over the world, and she says she came to them through their beauty.
Air quotes.
I was doing research in northern Thailand, and upon a garment, I discovered a fringe. And upon that fringe, metallic beetle wings had been strung. They were so beautiful. I really had trouble, like, believing that they were real.
So she is talking about bug clothes, Sam.
Bugs.
Can you believe
clothes.
This woman?
I cannot believe it.
Anyways, so she's out here to remind people that however disgusting, repugnant, unlovable these little freaks may seem, they do make the world go round. And she makes this point in her latest exhibit, and this is part of the Fragile Earth exhibition at the Florence Griswold Museum in Old Lyme, Connecticut. And she's got hundreds of insects, actually pretty beautiful, preserved, multicolored beetles, grasshoppers, katydids. They're pinned in these patterned designs on the walls of this historic home, and it kind of looks like insect wallpaper.
Oh.
So over the years, she's found it more and more difficult to get her hands on certain bugs maybe that were always available to her. And so a focus of her work now is to kind of make people aware of what's happening in bug world.
A really important study came out in 2017 that was a study in Germany that discovered that over a 27-year period, 75% of winged insects were gone, which that is incredibly fast. And that is a lot of insects. And I don't think the situation is unique to Germany. Really, what's happening is a kind of apocalypse, annihilation of insects. And it's going to have severe repercussions.
The insect apocalypse.
The insect apocalypse.
But if this is true, someone needs to explain to me why no flies is a bad thing.
What are we waiting for? Let's do it.
So that's it. For the rest of the show, producer Jimmy Gutierrez takes a microscope to the so-called insect apocalypse to see if it's got any legs. What would the world look like with no bugs life? And can Jimmy learn to love the fly?
So when it comes to insects, there are an estimated 10 quintillion worldwide.
That's not a number you should make.
That's 10 with 18 zeros after it.
Okay. Well,
real number.
Yeah, I don't believe you.
That doesn't even include arthropods like spiders and mites.
Oh, really?
Yes. And if you're going strictly off of mass, arthropods outweigh humans a combined 17 times over. But with all that said, like you've heard earlier, things have been changing.
Yeah, so I think I heard this story for the first time about a year ago. Is that right?
Insects may be low on the food chain, but they are, of course, essential. And a growing body of research has set off alarms that the world could be in for big trouble.
A recent article in the New York Times reports some startling and disturbing news. Across the globe, whole insect populations are crashing.
The scientists who study insects, entomologists, are worried, and they say everyone else should be too.
The insect apocalypse is here.
There are three beats to the story. So things pick up first in late 2017, and that's with that German study that Jenny was talking about. The big finding there was that the mass of flying insects, which was measured in the national parks all over Germany, had fallen by 80% in 3 decades. Right after that, the New York Times magazine came out with this brilliant article. The headline asked, "What does this all mean for the rest of life on Earth?"
Yeah, that's the one I read.
Pump is primed. Everyone can freak out about this. And that's when a couple of researchers go over 70 studies across the globe, and they came to the conclusion that within the century, all insects could be gone.
Within one century?
Within the next century.
That seems...
great.
I was going to say unlikely.
Of course, it's true that many insects that can be a nuisance for us can be, but on a larger scale, the majority of them are not.
This is Francisco Sanchez-Bio. He is an ecologist and scientist working at the University of Sydney in Australia, and we caught up over Skype.
And they play the role in life like everything else in life. You know?
Okay, deep breath here. It is time to defend the bug. The first thing to note in the defense of bugs is the role that they play in ecosystems and how it affects humans. An example of this that I learned, Sir Samuel, are the dung beetles.
Yeah.
Who save U.S. farmers an estimated $380 million a year. Do you know how they do this?
I assume it has something to do with rolling dung away, because that's all you ever see them doing.
Rolling dung and also eating dung.
They eat it?
They eat it.
Which, how does that save money?
So by removing all that mess, They're also removing the habitats of the things that would live in that mess that destroy animal and plant lives, as well as enriching the soil with their rolling techniques.
Yeah. Well, and their leavings too, I'm sure.
So back to Francisco. He's one of the authors of that study last year that pretty much said insects like the dung beetle will be gone in a century.
Mm-hmm.
And our farms could be overflowing with shit. Are you kind of surprised just how much media attention the report has kind of gotten since you've put it out there? I mean, it's not like you're talking about polar bears or honeybees for that matter.
Very good. Yeah, we are quite surprised. In fact, I mean, we knew that we were going to have some impact because our review study, it's not an experimental study, it's a review of papers. Just been going through the literature and digging up all what some people have written.
I mean, just for a little breakdown of how their process worked, him and his team went through 73 different papers worldwide, and they searched for keywords like insect survey and decline.
I was immediately skeptical of when the headline conclusion, and what you just said really cements it for me, because I think searching the keyword decline and finding studies that show a decline kind of feels like a fishing expedition.
Yeah, that's been pointed out by like the critics of this paper, and they don't question if populations are declining. It's just that they think that the study overestimates how fast this is all happening.
So then what's the culprit here?
Okay, so there are like four main focal points to this paper. One, climate change.
Duh.
Another is biological factors. Now, this is taking in things like pathogens, introduced and invasive species. Third being chemical pollution. And finally, and most devastating, is habitat destruction.
This is one of these things that I hear all the time from ecologists, that we're all freaked out about climate change, but that if you look at the actual drivers of species loss today, it is not climate change. Yet it is still just old-fashioned, you know, disruption of habitat.
For Francisco, he sees that the most in his area of study, which is agriculture.
And among these chemicals, of course, pesticides are the major killers of these animals, because insecticides in particular are designed to kill insects.
In particular, Francisco wants us to talk about pollinators because, well, that's where it starts to get people like us.
Like you.
Like me. That's where he starts to get people like me aboard the bug bus.
And for us, pollination is the most evident without them, we wouldn't eat most of the fruit we eat these days. We'll have to come back to eat only bread and water and maybe some meat, you know? That's it. So we wouldn't have fruits. We wouldn't have strawberries, blueberries, pumpkins. All these plants need pollination by insects.
Wow, that is the prime selling point to, like, to get people to care about insects right there. No more fruit, only bread.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a very good way of putting it, you know?
All right, yo, he is talking about taking us back to the Bible diet.
You mean just like bread and water?
Bread, water, meat. Listen, we wouldn't even have wine. We wouldn't even have grapes for good wine.
So, okay, so as somebody who is fond of a fruit smoothie in the morning,
ooh, yes.
this, I assume, is getting you on board with bugs, finally?
I mean, if it meant that I had to switch to like a meat smoothie, like I will be out on the corners saying, save the pollinators.
I think we have a solution to this already, right? Is that you just pay workers to go around with Q-tips and pollinate by hand. Isn't that happening already?
Capitalism.
Yeah.
To solve all our problems. What Francisco's findings lead to is this huge shift in our world, right? Like how we eat, how we live, how we interact with the world around us. And I asked him, thinking about all of that, if he was ever concerned that the language he used might be too alarmist.
Yeah, no, I have no qualms about the language we used. And there is some criticism from some quarters about some people is because maybe they don't understand or they don't grasp the problem as they should.
Okay, so I'm really glad you asked him that question about alarmism, because I have to say, environmentalists don't have a great track record when it comes to predicting the future of really complex systems, especially in cases where there's a lot that we don't understand. And I know that there's a ton about bugs that we just don't know.
Mm. That is reassuring. I will also say that within the scientific community and people that are studying bugs and bug life, this is not consensus.
Mm-hmm. When you start looking more closely at the data, one of the things that kind of points that jumps out at you is that a lot of the claims that have been made about the insect Armageddon or insect apocalypse are based on very small amounts of data.
More bugs, bug science, and we put Jimmy's disgust to the test when Outside In continues. Hey, we're back. I'm Sam Evans Brown, and producer Jimmy Gutierrez and I are talking about the so-called insect apocalypse, spending more time with bug folk.
And I am taking this time as an opportunity for personal growth to see if I can at least learn to appreciate our many-legged companions.
Well, I think that most people who actually spend a little bit of time with an entomologist, it's hard not to catch the bug, right? Catch the bug.
Oh. This is Dr. Jessica Ware. She's an entomologist working at Rutgers.
Kind of famous. Yeah.
Something I've learned about people who like do this work and work with bugs is like they find that one, right? Like that one that speaks to them.
Yeah.
With her, it's dragonflies and damselflies,
mm-hmm.
which she broke down and they sound pretty raw.
They're colorful and charismatic and they're near fresh water. And if they're around you, there's going to be fewer gnats, fewer mosquitoes, fewer black flies, fewer horse flies. They're the ones that are consuming the things that are plaguing us.
So if this were a movie, this is the part where the montage of you like being remade into a better person would start?
What can I say? I'm a work in progress. I asked Jessica what she thought of Francisco's paper, the fact that 40% of insects could be extinct in the next couple decades, and then within a century, they could all be gone.
Well, I mean, like any human that reads a report like that, my first reaction is to feel, oh, goodness, this is something we should panic about. And certainly, as a scientist, I know from my personal work or from the work of my colleagues that there's not enough of us out there doing work to collect baseline data on insect populations.
Right. So there's just not enough people out there looking for bugs. So really any scientific claim is going to be based on really thin evidence.
And that's the big critique, that there just aren't enough people doing the work. So, okay, let's say like the insect Armageddon was like the movie Armageddon, right?
Hmm.
We still can't detect that asteroid. Now, that doesn't mean it's not coming.
Not going to hit us.
It's not going to hit us. Or that we don't need to worry about the Bible diet coming back anytime soon.
Right, we just can't say for sure what is happening. Like, we've got some worrying signs.
Right, and Jessica did say that while this framing isn't ideal for her,
The fact that people are finally paying attention, this is a big deal.
It's wonderful. Many of us who are entomologists have been portrayed as being perhaps off on the sidelines, not really mainstream. And so the idea that you can open up a newspaper or that you can, you know, log onto your phone and have insect stories as your top stories is exciting. So if the discussion of insect apocalypse sparks the average person to read an article about insects and learn about insects on their day, that's good. I wouldn't deny that. I worry about needing to have everything be so sensationalized in order to get people to learn about it, of course. On the other hand, I wonder whether there really is any benefit in kind of squabbling about it at all. I mean, whether we have enough data right now or not, most scientists would agree that something's happening. Anecdotally, we see changes.
Do you remember Car Talk?
Sam, this is public radio. Who doesn't remember Car Talk?
Well, there was this call that was made to Car Talk at some point where the listener was like, hey, how come I don't see so many bugs splattered on my windshield anymore? Are all the bugs dead? And the Car Talk guys were like, no. It's just that cars are more aerodynamic now. And I think about that a lot because, you know, in the absence of really good comprehensive data, all we've really got are like these 73 papers that Francisco Sanchez Bio reviewed, and each of them is kind of like a windshield, right? And so we've just got these little glimpses, each of which might have their own explanation and might not be representative, or maybe they are, but we just don't know.
The bigger point, I think, too, is like this is like this moment of anxiety, right? Like we've had decades of just complacency and inaction on environmental stuff. And now you see people taking action, whether it be, you know, the nationwide climate strikes.
Now, the global protest that is underway right now, students and workers all around the world are flooding.
You
the
see
streets.
It in youth-led movements.
We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money.
You see it in folks suing their own governments for not taking action.
My name is Yutesca Tonatiu. I'm a 15-year-old climate warrior, spokesperson for my generation, and I'm suing the United States government for violating my constitutional right to a healthy atmosphere.
You remember Jenny Angus? She was earlier the insect ally and the artist.
Yes.
So she's hoping that this moment, like all this momentum that we have for creepy crawlers, leads to like an increase in funding for exhibits, museums, and the science. Because if we want to know what's happening with bugs, we need more people out there studying them and interacting with them. I mean, I didn't even know what a taxonomist was before the story started, let alone that there was a shortage of them.
How do you even work on this show?
That is a great question.
They study taxis, right?
They actually group and classify different kinds of insects, Samuel. No, not just insects, but here we're talking about insects.
Poindexter, Jimmy.
The benefits of funding more taxonomists, more long-term ecological and evolutionary studies of insects, the benefits would be amazing. It would be stupendous. It could transform what we do as humans. I can't underscore enough how much funding basic research, training systematists and taxonomists, training evolutionary biologists from around the globe. It would change everything.
I can say I'm a convert to championing why we need bugs and why the bug apocalypse would be terrible. But I think we also need people to like bugs, right? To want to work with bugs, want to classify, ID, and count them. And I asked Jessica, as someone who wants to keep the dung beetle around, even as nasty as they are, how do I get on her level? How can I love the fly, right? And for her, she said she grew up in Canada and spent a ton of time outside. And a lot of that time was spent with her grandparents, her grandma in particular. And they would just explore nature together.
She would always point out dragonflies and damselflies that were near Lake Muskoka, which is a lake on which she lives. And she would point out snakes and encourage us to pick up frogs and just not to be afraid of the natural world. And she really fed this innate curiosity that we had. She really encouraged it. And so I think by seeing her, you know, by when children see grown-ups that are not afraid of insects, I think it makes them feel comfortable to try to spend some time and explore the things that they're curious about. I'm a parent, and my kids learned so much at school about barnyard animals. They know exactly what a pig says or what a lamb says. But they don't know, they didn't learn anything about dragonflies. And I think that's so perplexing when there's 6,000 species of dragonflies and damselflies. And that's more than the total number of mammals on Earth. So
that is wild. All right, so I see the light, Sam. This isn't just about me liking the fly. This is about we liking the fly. Anyways, I've got an idea for how we level up our bug love.
Yeah?
Pack your bags, buddy. We're going to Boston.
Boston!
So there's a six-story red brick building on Harvard's campus.
Like all of them.
Head in, walk up a few flights of stairs, past a makeshift gift shop, and then you can buy a beetle-themed throw blanket if you'd like. Turn a corner, and you're there.
Bug World.
Harvard's Museum of Natural History.
We don't always have the live bugs, as long as people know that, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
I am both terrified and grateful that you do.
Yeah.
This is the Arthropod Gallery. It's filled with colorless corpses of spiders, scorpions, and giant lobsters.
Arthropods, which is the overarching taxa, right? And then there are insects, arachnids, and hexapods. Aren't there more than that?
I mean, I hope not, but probably.
Your dread is, like, giving me a lot of joy right now.
I'm happy I can provide that for you, Sam.
So to help us make sense of this nightmare, I'm sorry, I mean, learning experience or moment for growth was Crystal Meyer.
Like, one of my earliest memories was of my great-grandmother, and I found this huge woolly bear caterpillar, and I was so excited, and I was like 3 years old or something like that, and I run up to her with this woolly bear caterpillar, and she knocks it out of my hand, she steps on it, and she says, "Little girls don't play with bugs." And I was like, okay, my life will be dedicated.
Today, Crystal is a coleopterist. Did I nail that?
That's a beetle expert.
Yes. I mean, she studies and collects beetles. And she's also the entomology collections manager at the museum.
Well, do we want to see some cockroaches?
Are you up for this, too? Are you going to?
Yeah.
Of course.
These are my personal cockroaches.
So this is Shoyo Sato. He's a grad student who studies spiders. And I don't know, I guess just for kicks, he has a bunch of cockroaches.
Okay. Sam, I need some moral support here.
So these are Madagascar hissing cockroaches. They're native to Madagascar. So let's see if I can make them hiss. Can you hear that?
It's like biting you. Why is it doing that to you?
So they hiss when they're annoyed. You can see they're not like your cockroaches that you have at home. They're very slow. Yes. They just sort of sit there.
Yeah.
These guys are actually pretty clean. They spend a lot of time grooming.
So Sam, how are you feeling right now, buddy?
I will confess that I feel like bodily a little queasy when I feel its legs on me. I'm habituating. As he's moving around, it's like, okay, I'm no longer feeling actively queasy.
Okay.
You ready for this?
No.
Do you want to?
Yeah, I can transfer it.
Yeah.
There's something crawling in my hand. Mm-hmm. It's going somewhere.
So this is like. Mm. This might be...
My like toes are curling. That's tight.
How you feeling? Are you habituating?
I think I am habituating. I'm like not shaking as much, which is good. And actually, like I think like watching her just kind of be curious of me and the antenna go. I don't know, like
a little bit of kinship.
Yeah, we're figuring this out together. Still gross.
Do you remember even seeing like the kids jump in there?
Yeah.
Here are brothers Johan and Rainer Dieth, and they're checking out Crystal's beetle collection.
What do you think about these beetles?
Small.
You're small? Are you afraid at all? Or are you kind of just like curious?
I'm just curious.
How about you?
Yeah, I'm definitely curious about new species of beetles because it would be cool to see like what changes they have.
And there was this one kid, Praveen.
Do you think you could ever hold it? Yeah?
Who held the cockroaches.
How do the legs feel?
They're sickly on my nail.
And even got his dad, Shreden, to hold one.
Oh, wow, it's ticklish. It is so ticklish.
And it was really different to be around, like, so many people who were, like, pro-bug, like, yes, put this in my hand, as opposed to, we're on the wrong floor, please let's get out of here immediately.
It's infectious. It rubs off.
It did rub off.
Yeah.
Hopefully that's all that rubbed off.
But I felt like we were like really exposed to a lot. And I remember asking Crystal, like, for folks who can't get to the museum or call up like insect allies, how do they try and love the fly?
Go outside and catch bugs. That's the way to do it. They're everywhere. They're in your backyard, they're on the street, they're on your lawn, they're on campus. And all you have to do, like, it's not like a, I don't know, a snake or a bird or something like that. You turn over a log and there's a whole ecosystem underneath that log waiting to be discovered. And there's probably new species under there too.
So, insect apocalypse, mm-hmm. The jury's still out, but if you're worried, get over your irrational fears and start, pitching in to the great international bug count.
You know, after this whole story and time that we spend here, I gotta admit, I'm starting to feel a little, like I'm turning into a giant fly.
Starting to feel a little Jeff Goldblum-y?
A little Jeff Goldblum. I mean, I would take the Jeff Goldblum-y.
But what is scarier, turning into a giant fly or a world without fruit?
No!
That is it for today. I really hope you're all doing okay out there and finding time to enjoy some outdoor magic in whatever safe ways you can. If you feel inspired to do some bird watching or some bug loving, please send us your notes and pictures at outsidein@nhpr.org. And if you also feel inspired, please give to NHPR right now to keep shows like this one going. You'll find a link to donate at nhpr.org. Outside In was produced this week by Taylor Quimby, Jimmy Gutierrez, and me, Sam Evans-Brown, with help from Justine Paradise. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is the director of the Beetlejuice Jamboree. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Additional music by Blue Dot Sessions, Poddington Bear, and Taylor Quimby. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.